We are pilgrims. They were pilgrims. They were lovers of God. They were dreamers, idealists. Being lovers of God, they were also firm in their faith and thus a bit overconfident. They had a can-do American attitude. They were a little crazy, really. 102 of them crammed into what was probably a 113-foot boat, plus everything they would need maybe for the rest of their lives. That's a little crazy. I don't think I would have done it. The Mayflower traveled about 2 miles per hour, and the trip was 3,000 miles across the Atlantic, so altogether it took 66 days. I can only imagine how terrifying it was and how claustrophobic everyone must have felt. Very little was written about the voyage by any of the people who made it. But William Bradford wrote that the Mayflower left Plymouth, England, with a prosperous wind. I'm sure they were all loving God extra hard that day. William Bradford wrote, "If they looked behind them, there was the mighty ocean which they had passed and was now as a main bar and gulf to separate them from all the civil parts of the world." In grammar school, I learned that the pilgrims came to North America for religious freedom. Turns out it was a little more complicated than that. For 12 years before the Mayflower, the pilgrims had been living in Holland. In Holland, they had all the religious freedom they wanted. What they didn't have was control. William Bradford, who was both governor of Plymouth and head storyteller, wrote that one of the most important reasons the pilgrims wanted to come to the New World was because their children were being corrupted by Dutch culture. The pilgrims didn't just want religious freedom. They wanted to build their own society from scratch. They wanted to do it their own way. They wanted to be alone. They were not alone. It's not that the pilgrims didn't know that there were native people living in North America. There had been a number of expeditions by then and fantastic reports about the amazing creatures and plants and artifacts found in the New World. It's just that the pilgrims and the Indians had very different ideas about land. The Indians didn't go around claiming ownership of land. Therefore, the logic went, since they didn't own it, it didn't belong to them. The land was inhabited, but it was empty, if that makes sense. Even though the Indians didn't own the land, the colonists didn't feel right about just taking it. There had to be some kind of purchase. The Indians were happy to sell. It was the neighborly thing to do. Problem was, the Indians weren't selling the same thing the colonists were buying. The Indians were selling land usage rights, the right to hunt, the right to fish, the right to plant crops. Everyone knows that land belongs to everyone, like water and air. The Indians introduced the settlers to wampum, which means shell beads in the Narragansett language. Purple and white wampum beads were woven into belts and used for ceremonies or for trade or to mark important occasions. Often there were pictures woven in to tell a story, like a kind of writing. Money, thought the settlers, and they started making their own. Sometimes wampum was part of the payment for land. I guess this was the beginning of the North American housing boom. The land in New England was not empty, but it was way emptier when the Mayflower arrived than it had been just a few years before. All those European explorers had brought some terrible germs. The Wampanoags, people of the first light, became people of the first contact. An estimated 90% of them were dead by 1620. The seal of the Massachusetts Bay Colony was an image of an Indian holding a bow, his arrow facing downward in a gesture of peace, saying, "Come over and help us." That's American spirit for you. We're always here to help. John Eliot wanted to help. John Eliot wanted to bring Jesus to the native people. He spent many years living among them, learning their language and teaching them English ways, like how to cut their hair and how to wear pants. With help from an Indian named John Sassamon, John Eliot translated the Bible into Algonquin so that the Indians could read it for themselves and be saved. John Eliot's Indian Bible was the first Bible to be printed in North America. It was a labor of biblical proportions, a labor of love. It took 10 years for John Eliot to write his translation and 4 more years to print it. It took me only a month to carve 1 page of Algonquin for this print. Harvard College wanted to help too. In a quest to make Harvard the Indian Oxford, they built an Indian college on campus. The first 2 native students at Harvard Indian College, class of 1665, were Caleb Chishutamok and Joel Iacombs. They were Aquinnah Wampanoag from Martha's Vineyard. As is true of many Harvard students, they were from upper-class families. Joel was set to be class valedictorian, but he was killed in a shipwreck off Nantucket just before graduation. Caleb graduated, but he died of tuberculosis soon afterward. It was 305 years before the next Native American graduated from Harvard. That's 1970. They were real people. My Mayflower ancestors were John and Priscilla Alden. I'm one in a million, since that many Americans are descended from this couple. Lots of people recognize the Alden name, but that's not because of anything John and Priscilla actually did. Their name recognition comes from an 1858 poem called The Courtship of Miles Standish, written by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Longfellow himself was an Alden descendant. Most of what he wrote in his famous poem has little or no basis in historical fact. The facts are thin. All we know is that John was a cooper, which is a barrel maker, and Priscilla was the teenage daughter of a shoe salesman. William Bradford wrote that John Alden, quote, being a hopeful young man, was much desired. I take that to mean that John Alden was a hunk. Priscilla was the only member of her family to survive the first winter. John was surely kind to take her under his wing. It's hard to imagine what these people were really like. There's not a lot to go on. Journals or church and court records mostly. Women's lives are especially undocumented, but one intriguing tale I found was the story of Dorothy Mae Bradford, wife of William Bradford. William Bradford, who documented absolutely everything Plymouth, never wrote one word about Dorothy. A generation later, Puritan historian Cotton Mather wrote that one day, as the Mayflower lay moored in Provincetown Harbor and William was away on a scouting mission, Dorothy accidentally slipped over the side of the ship and drowned. Given that the ship was anchored, there was no mention of a storm, and that the waters were shallow, some have speculated that Dorothy committed suicide. This gives us a glimpse of the sheer terror these people must have felt in the face of a strange and barren new land in the dead of winter. I wonder if Dorothy ever even set foot on North American soil. From Egypt to the Roman Empire to Native America, as far back as historians can document, there have been men who loved men and women who loved women. The so-called unnatural act of homosexuality is in fact a naturally occurring human trait. Whether or not it's desirable is another matter, and one that's culturally defined. The Puritans defined homosexuality as undesirable. Now, that didn't deter two Plymouth Colony men, John Alexander and Thomas Roberts, who were brought to trial in 1637 and were found guilty of performing ongoing homosexual acts with each other. Homosexuality was punishable by death back then, but the two received less severe punishments. Apparently, Massachusetts magistrates have always been soft on gays. John Alexander, a free man, was whipped, burned on the shoulder with a branding iron, and banished from the colony. Thomas Roberts, an indentured servant, was whipped and returned to his master, forbidden to ever own any land within the colony. But for a brief entry in the court records, we would never even know that they existed. Today, one of the first things we think of when we think about the Puritans is that they were uptight about sex. Puritanical, we call it. Now, it's true that the Puritans punished extramarital sex and sexual activities that didn't promote conception, but they were surprisingly enthusiastic about marital sex. Frequent and mutually satisfying sex was both a right and a duty for both partners in a marriage. A woman could get a divorce if her husband didn't properly satisfy her. Puritans believed that conception required a mutual orgasm, and medical texts recommended good food, wine, a relaxed atmosphere, and foreplay. Hardly the puritanical attitudes we so blithely accuse our founding fathers and mothers of possessing. Sociologist William Gibson says that when a culture is in crisis, the first response is often to go back to the creation myth to start over again. That's what I've been grasping for as I've worked on these prints. Our American creation myth, our American Bible story. They were pilgrims. They were brave. They were naive. They were arrogant. They were scared. They were simple. They were confused. They were ignorant. They were brilliant. They were tired. They were poor. In America, still, every generation brings a new group of pilgrims. May it always be so. We are pilgrims. These are our people.